Hello and welcome to another edition of Radio Free Market World Report with me, your host, Andy Duncan. The situation in Europe is close to melting point. The senior politicians and bureaucrats of the EU in Brussels, Belgium, have been discussing how they can fleece their citizens over the next few decades to pay off all of their enormous government debts, raised to buy votes, pay off favours, and subsidise the infamous European social model. Bank industry technocrats have taken over the governments of Greece, Italy, and probably take over Portugal, Spain, and Ireland. To discuss these complex matters, I'm joined this morning from Brussels in Belgium by Vincent J. Deroux. Vincent is the former Director of Programmes of the Alliance of European Conservatives and Reformists and is currently the Managing Director of NACMA, a boutique consultancy he founded this year. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning, Andy. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Even though I live in England, close to Europe, but unfortunately still within the EU, although for how long, who knows, I'm completely baffled by what's been going on in Brussels in the last 2 or 3 days. Can you describe the current situation and what do you think is going to happen to the euro fiat currency next?
Basically, it's all very baffling for, I mean, many other people as well, both in Europe and outside Europe. In order to understand basically what's happening now in Europe, you need to go back a bit in history and go back to the late 80s and the early 90s when the European elites and bureaucrats basically decided that the way ahead for the EU was to transform the common market as it was intended into a full political union, including a common European currency, which was called the ECU and later on the euro. Of course, as I'm sure you know and many of your listeners might know, the economic rationale behind the euro never existed. It was a vanity project right from the start, meant to be some kind of trigger to show to the world that the EU was more or less a state in its own right. So what's going to happen next? I mean, we had a big European summit yesterday and the day before in Brussels, whereby the leaders of the EU, except for the British Prime Minister who refused to sign the compromise, was to set up a full fiscal union at the European level. So basically, they're pushing forward now a major treaty change or even a new treaty, depending on how they can solve this legally, to give the EU level all competences in matters of fiscal policy, linked to that also taxation policy and the management of the debt levels of member states. So what will happen now from here? Basically, perhaps for the short run, the problems can be tackled this way. But in the long run, I'm pretty sure the system remains flawed and dangerously unstable.
So how long do you think that this current compromise is going to last before it also needs to be fixed again?
By the springtime, they might need to resort to a different kind of solution or even try to, I mean, make the rules more stringent and more severe, because I don't see any real way now how basically, I mean, putting all your power and your decision power into the hands of Brussels bureaucrats might suddenly, like, calm the markets down. Although we have seen in Greece and Italy, two other countries that have been taken over by, let's say, EU-style bureaucrats, to say the least, that the markets at first have responded fairly well. But I remain pretty skeptic when it comes to the long run.
You say the bureaucrats in Brussels, but are they really a fig leaf in disguise for bureaucrats in Berlin? I was recently for my sins in Frankfurt in Germany, and I was absolutely stunned to find a 30-foot plastic blue statue of the euro fiat currency symbol in the Willy Brandt Plaza. Much of the reasoning put forward in Britain in the 1970s to get us into what you told us earlier was the common market was the idea that Germany's enormous power would be muzzled by such an arrangement. I grew up reading war books, and in the war books there was always Tommy Atkins with a machine gun always shooting Germans, and there were always Germans shooting Tommy Atkins. So the mood in Britain at the time, even in the 70s, was still very kind of based on the Second World War. And yet now, like moths to a flame, the European dream has led to a point where German power will soon dictate to everyone else in Europe how they're going to lead their lives via Merkel and the Merkel-Sarkozy axis without a single Wehrmacht bullet needing to be fired. Do you think we're seeing a Fourth Reich emerging? Is this just one unplanned socialist mistake after another with fix after fix after fix? Or have the banking technocrats who you just described got other more sinister plans for us?
Of course, Daniel, what you're saying is indeed correct. I mean, this is a fix after fix and basically a mistake after mistake. But I do not believe that this is that what we're witnessing here is the emergence of a Fourth Reich, because we cannot forget that Germany here is not really the bad guy. The villain is France, and the villain has always been France. The EU was set up to kind of trick Germany into accepting a framework whereby decisions about German policy would be taken elsewhere. And now in the last decade, because of, the German position is, within the EU, it is the driving economic force behind the EU. It is the strongest economy in Europe, at least when it comes to total output and total GDP. And this country has always been forced into some kind of inferior position vis-a-vis France, who, of course, as you all know, is a country with very big problems. So I do not see in the latest evolution in Germany, whereby Angela Merkel, the Chancellor, is becoming a bit more aggressive towards other European countries, that this is not the start of a Fourth Reich or a new era of German imperialism or dominance, but just a counter reaction which is triggered by the fact that in her home country, in Germany, Merkel's governing coalition has suffered severe setbacks and losses in recent elections, because the German electorate, the German people, they are tired of having to pay and having to pick up the tab and pick up the bill and pay the bills that are actually left behind by other European countries. And now in the last couple of weeks, at least we see that the German politicians who regularly come to Brussels are at least reflecting the wish and the desires of the German people instead of just their own.
I think it was François Mitterrand who made the Germans give up the Deutschmark in order to bring the two Germanies together of East and West Germany. Do you think that the Germans might even go so far as to pull out of the euro before anyone else leaves to reform the Deutschmark?
That's the big question that everyone is asking himself here in Brussels, I'm sure also in Berlin and in Frankfurt and in Paris. It would make sense for Germany, with or without some other strong currency countries such as the Netherlands, Finland, probably Austria, and maybe some Central European ones who are willing to have these very strict budgetary and monetary conditions and requirements in place. That would probably make sense from a German point of view. But of course, the question remains, this is not about saving the euro. It is about saving the grand European project. And the euro is considered to be an integral part of that great European project. So the moment the euro fails, the bureaucrats and the EU leaders will perceive it as if the EU has failed. And that's an entire different story. I think it makes sense for Germany to leave. It makes sense for some other countries to join that Northern Euro, or whatever name they would give it. But whether I see this happening in the short run or even the long run is an entirely different thing. Of course, we all remember Germany under the Weimar Republic and hyperinflation. So I would guess that the only moment that the German political caste will finally decide to defend their own people and their own economy and no longer defend the economies and pay for it of other European countries will be the moment that there is double-digit inflation and then real inflation in the real economy, or even hyperinflation at some point hitting Germany. And only at that point do I see the German elites having enough courage to go to Brussels and to say, we want our Deutschmark back.
That will be someday. Now, in that list of countries you mentioned earlier, in what I might call the greater Deutschmark potential area, I would have expected you a year ago to mention another country, which is Belgium, in which you live, but you didn't. You didn't mention it. You mentioned the Netherlands and Finland and Austria. Now, one of the reasons for that is about the Dexia Bank in Belgium, which came under a lot of scrutiny recently. Even though I work in and around the City of London doing various things for various people, I had never heard of Dexia until I heard them in the news and then found out they're one of the biggest banks in the world. Can you tell us about what happened with Dexia and what this has meant for Belgium?
The reason why you didn't know Dexia before is probably because, you're not a Belgian and you're not on the city council in some city or town in the world, because Dexia is the world leader, or was the world leader, in the market of financial services to the public sector. So basically, Dexia was active in all EU countries, most other European countries, and also in countries such as Turkey, Israel, Canada, and even in the US. Dexia Bank was basically created as the merger of the big, called the Communal Credit Bank of Belgium, and the Local Credit of France. And later on, they took on banks Greeks in Italy, like Krediop, or Israel, like Otzar, Hashilton, Hamekomi, who were all leaders in their respective countries when it came to borrowing money and doing credit enhancement for local authorities. They also purchased FSA in the U.S., which is the Financial Security Assurance Bank, which is also the biggest credit enhancement company for municipalities in the U.S. So this bank was a huge bank, but of course it was struck in the 2008-2009 credit crunch and financial crisis because it had invested a lot of money in companies such as Lehman Brothers, and they also lost money in the Bernie Madoff scandal, and the bank had to be bailed out in 2008, which is when the board members were replaced by politicians. And it only took them a couple of years to get the bank back in trouble because the bank was investing huge amounts of money, billions, hundreds of billions of euros in government debt. And then when the debt crisis hit Europe, the bank had to be saved a second time. And the Belgian government this year decided that it would no longer go for a real proper bailout, but it would nationalize the bank, keep it in the government's hands and portfolio until it manages to sell off the profitable or less unsuccessful subsidiaries. And they have basically put all the troubled assets, which is basically a 95 billion euro bond portfolio, and they've put them in a bad bank. And you'll find Dexia Bank still on the Brussels Stock Exchange. But that Dexia Bank now is basically that bad bank. So they've now decided, because a bailout always helps the shareholders, and now they've decided that the shareholders should basically face the music and they should bear the consequences of their actions and their investments.
We had a similar situation with Northern Rock in the UK, where the good bit has been sold to Virgin and the bad bit has been left with the taxpayer, which is nice. Staying with Belgium, we saw a complete lack of government for a long time, I think 2 years, as various Flemish and French Belgian politicians bickered themselves to a complete standstill. However, last Monday, I believe, alas, this has changed and now you have a government again. The Belgian government is back. Can you describe how you ended up with no government for a long time, and how did this vampire manage to revive itself from the dead?
So, Andy, we've had 1.5 years of, let's say, political anarchy, which was basically the result of the fact that Belgium as a country no longer exists. I mean, if it had ever existed in the first place, but now it no longer exists. We have a Dutch-speaking majority of 60% of the population in the north and a French-speaking minority of 40% in the south. And both parts have their own media, their own language, their own political institutions, their own political debate. And the Belgian public sphere no longer exists. So what happened was in the last election, it became obvious that the southern part of the country had chosen to elect center-left to far-left people. And in the north, people had elected people who called themselves to be on the center-right of politics. And the Belgian constitution requires a Belgian government to have the backing of basically both sides, of a majority of both groups in that government. And it took 1.5 years to come to a compromise on the policies of that government. And that's basically what triggered this 1.5 year of political anarchy. Now, you asked, how did this vampire manage to revive itself from the dead? This, of course, is caused by this euro crisis. I remember myself writing an article in 2008 when we had another political crisis that lasted over 1 year without the government. And then I was claiming that the reason why they could, like, decide to postpone all compromises and keep the thing running was because Belgium did not have a currency of its own anymore, and basically the currency was stable. Today, we live in a different world, and now the reason for the government to finally get his acts together and form government coalition was also created or induced by this euro crisis, because now the markets were targeting the Belgian government and short-selling Belgian bonds. So now, certainly politicians felt a need to transcend their differences and come up with a compromise. And of course, for libertarians, the compromise is pretty bad.
Do you feel safer in your bed now that the Belgian government has recreated itself?
When I use the word political anarchy, I mean, I don't mean anarchy in the sense that people might actually use the word for. Belgium is a country with 9 governments, 9 parliamentary assemblies, and only one of those 9 did not reach a political governing coalition compromise. So basically, Belgium has always been under government control in the last 1.5 years. And actually, another reason, I think, why the Walloons, the southern Belgians, finally accepted the terms of some agreement was because they also noticed in society that more and more people were basically thinking that there was no need to have a Belgian government, which, of course, would have further strengthened the, let's say, the secessionist movements in the north of the country.
Where I live in the UK, I think I live under six different layers of government, and I never feel safe without knowing there's these six levels of government controlling my life. Getting back to the EU, how do you think this current EU and ECB chaos is going to resolve itself in the long run?
To me, the euro crisis is like what we're witnessing is a train crash in slow motion. And some people say it without someone in the driver's seat. I disagree with that because there's plenty of people in the driver's seat. It is just blatant incompetence and not understanding the true mechanisms of society and economics. So how will it resolve itself? I am sure that the ECB, which has now been buying up bad debt from the member states who were unable to finance that debt on the private market themselves, they will keep buying up those bonds at rock bottom interest rates to counter whatever the increasing spread on the market. I mean, you can buy bonds for free. So somewhere they need to print money to pay for that process. So they will keep printing money out of thin air until the moment that the monetary inflation will trickle down to the real economy. And of course, in Austrian school theory, inflation is measured on the basis of the bank increasing its money supply or not. But in society itself, in a debate in society, inflation is seen as the increases in consumer prices, which, given that all banks or most of the banks are holding a lot of the cheap ECB credit in cash on their balances and are not lending it out, the monetary inflation has not yet trickled down to the real economy. And we're now witnessing or experiencing inflation rates so between 3-5%, according to government statistics. So the moment that inflation will really hit the real economy and governments will no longer be able to tell the people that there is no inflation and that printing money is and remains a good thing, at that moment, I think the euro eventually will break apart or will completely disappear.
Well, let's all pray for that. Speaking about government statistics, they would say that we've never been freer, though you and I know differently. How do you think we can preserve what's left of freedom in Europe, those of us who live here, in the face of growing financial repression from the EU and other organisations? Or even, God forbid, how can we extend this freedom that we have?
This basically depends on your personal fortune and your personal wealth and the way you make your living. Of course, I'm a bit of a pessimist when it comes to the immediate future of the EU, but I'm also sure that the same is true in the US and many other countries with similar institutions and similar problems. And I'm also sure that, like, on the internet, if you check some Austrian school or libertarian website, you do find a proper textbook or copybook of what the stuff you have to do. If you're making money which is not linked to the territory you actually live on, put your companies offshore. If you have wealth you would like to keep safe from the hands of government, move your wealth offshore. Another thing, if you're thinking of buying property, think twice, because as we've seen in Greece, the easiest way to tax people is to tax stuff they cannot move. So the moment you've bought a house or an apartment, there is no way for you to not pay a tax levied on property, which is what happened in Greece. So basically, I would not start stockpiling food or ammunition, basically, but I would recommend everyone to take some precautions for the times ahead. Also, when it comes to, like, hyperinflation or inflation, don't invest in fiat currencies, and if you do, take fiat currencies that are proven to be stable, like the Singapore dollar and the New Zealand dollar, or invest in commodities or precious metals. But I think now, in the immediate future, there is no real option to extend your freedom. It is now about keeping your freedom and trying to keep as much of your individual, value that you can. Another thing is basically, I do not think that the EU or the fiat currency problem will basically end in tears. I'm afraid it will all end in tear gas, because the moment hyperinflation hits Europe, we might see riots in the street. It is very unclear to me, because I don't have a crystal ball, to see how that point will evolve. And for as long as there's 99% who feel they have the right to take away the livelihood of the 1% top earners, I think we haven't seen the worst yet.
It's interesting you say keep your wealth offshore and keep it fluid and mobile, because one of the major causes of freedom in Europe was the Dutch fishermen putting their wealth into fishing boats, which they could just sail away from Holland. And because of the way Holland flooded, all the kings in the area couldn't confiscate those things. And then when the Dutch sort of took over England in 1688, they brought into England all the same sort of policies they had in Holland, which was to do with helping merchants and people move things around, which then of course went to the United States, to New Amsterdam and New York and all those places. So that's an interesting thought. Murray Rothbard used to always be a short-term pessimist, but he was always a very long-term optimist at all times. So I think maybe we will come through this, but like you say, we need to be there on the other side, and the best way to do that is to preserve our wealth, if we have any, or to generate some if we have any, and then move it away from these parasites. But you might be able to help some people with some of this, especially people in Europe. So on a final note, Vincent, and thank you for your time so far, if people do want to keep up with your consultancy work in Brussels and Belgium, how do they find you?
My company is a boutique consultancy, so we don't really cater for the general public, and we don't even have a website. So basically, I would recommend everyone who is interested in those ideas or in advice or just wants to catch up with me to just find me on Facebook, where they can just tap in my name and I'll come up, and I'm very happy to answer questions and get in touch with people who would find it useful.
If anybody wants to do that, Vincent de Roek, is the spelling of Roek is R-O-E-C-K. I'd like to thank you very much, Vincent, for your time today. Thank you, Vincent de Roek, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
With a pleasure, Andy. Thank you very much.